is Betty Trammell with Oral History, sponsored by the Decatur Public Library. Our guest today is Mrs. Eloise Clark, who lives at the Orlando Hotel in Decatur. We are recording on June 23, 1987, at Mrs. Clark's apartment in the Orlando Hotel. It's a very warm day. You probably can hear the fan going, but we appreciate that very much. Well, welcome to our series, Mrs. Clark.
Thank you.
You're living in a very interesting location, downtown in Decatur, in what was formerly a first-class hotel. When was the Orlando converted from hotel to apartments?
Yes, the apartment, the hotel was made into apartments and was completed in 1982 for residents of this and other areas. It is not primarily Decatur people that live here, but they have come from all over the state.
In other words, it's a resident apartment.
It's a resident for older...
Apartment hotel.
Uh-huh. Very, yes.
Is it primarily for older people?
It is entirely for... No, I was going to say it is entirely. It is also for those people who can take care of themselves but maybe are on crutches, mm-hmm, or in wheelchairs. We have that type. But you must be able to care for yourself.
Okay.
If you live here.
Well, can you describe the old building and compare it to what it is now?
Yes, my research really brought back a lot of memories. In my earlier years, I always was hearing stories about the Orlando Hotel. And history did prove that this was the nicest hotel built south of Chicago. And it served great purpose because the trains brought people through here. Cars were not yet then available. And so people were very much, apartments were very, excuse me, a hotel room was a necessary thing for many of the people who passed through. And some would even make this their home. Some salesmen came through and they showed their wares in some of the rooms that were designated for salesmen. So it was a very, very much used house and for these people to use.
I suppose it was rather grand in the lobby?
It was very grand in the lobby, and I must say that in renovating it, even though they tried to keep the lobby looking as much like the old as possible, it has lost some of that.
Glamour.
That's right, the glamour. Our main office happens to be where the old registration desk was. Now there's an interesting story about this too. It was a long curved desk, the reception desk, and it was topped by marble. And I think there's someone in town who has that piece of marble that was the top of that desk. And then the rest of it was made for just sitting around, you know, sitting and reading and lounging and waiting for poor people. And at that time there was a south entrance as well as a Water Street entrance. And this was a covered portico, and it had a little street that jutted in off of the main street, and there was always a liveried doorman dressed in green and gold, you know, dressed in green and gold. And I remember seeing a man, but of course I don't know who that man was, but he would always escort the people in from their conveyances and into the lobby. Everything was done on a large scale.
Well, it sounds really exciting. You don't have doormen here today.
No.
What services do you have?
Well, as residents, these rooms are our homes, and they're probably, oh, a half dozen different layouts of apartments. When the renovators decided to take it over, they took out every wall, everything, and then redesigned it into apartments. We have two-bedroom apartments, a few, when a man and wife have to come in, and most of them are single, for single people, and most of them are women.
Do you have kitchens in each apartment?
I have a kitchen, yes. Nice kitchen.
Is there a dining room for people?
No. Now, I don't, if you think this is interesting, I found it extremely interesting when I think about the ballroom. The ballroom was on the second floor. The two elevators opened directly into that room, and they held, many hundreds of people. That is, if they were going to serve a meal there, a banquet there. And we have an interesting tale from one of, we have a resident here, and his name is Percy Anderson, and he started as a boy in the kitchen chipping ice. They have a lot of ice decorations, centerpieces and things. This man started in there kind of helping around, doing things. And he worked his entire life in the Orlando, and he finally became the head waiter. And he has a tale that he tells, and I'm not really sure if he's kidding me or not, because I never can tell from him. He says he has carried 20 meals from the kitchen, which was at the back of the lobby, and clear up to the front of the lobby and up the winding stairs, just on his arms.
Oh.
And I still don't know if he's telling me the truth, but I said, how in the world did you do that? And he said, by piling, 10 plates on each arm. That would be two stacks here on the left. So I don't know if that's a true story. He kids a lot. And it sounds like an impossible thing. But anyway, there have been many, many banquets and elegant affairs there. Dances, the big name dance bands came along. And a lot of people have a lot of happy memories of this place.
Well, it really is an exciting story. And you enjoy living in this environment?
I enjoy very much because as a child, when I was growing up, anybody that ever spoke about the Orlando, it just sounded like a glamorous place, and it was the place to go. And of course, it was a very busy hotel. Many, many of the greats would come, stay for some celebration or other, and a lot of history was made in this building.
Well, we certainly want to hear about that, but I think before we go on with the history of the hotel, we'd like to hear a little bit about your personal history. Where were you born?
Well, I was born in a little town east of here, southeast, Beaumont, Illinois. Mm-hmm. So I was close enough to hear these stories. And I lived there around the Beaumont, Monticello area till I was married, and we lived in Monticello then on. So we were there for several years.
You tell us something about your family, your mother and father?
My grandfather came from Denmark, and his wife came from Ireland. And my other grandparents, there is no interesting background to their history. However, I had two aunts who were missionaries in Africa. One all her life, and she buried her husband and two children over there. So,
what kind of childhood did you have in Bemis?
Well, my father was a farmer, and I just was, well, I was born in the town of Bemis, but we moved soon to the farm. And so it was always a farm that I, however, my grandfather was one of the fathers of Bemis. He, it seemed like any special meeting would end up in his living room. And he was quite a leader.
And on your father's
that's
side?
That's on my father's side. Quite a leader and very wise.
What was his name?
His name was Boyer.
Boyer.
B-O-W-Y-E-R.
Good.
We're different than the other Boyers. We have a W. So he was, my father had, he was one of seven children and he was the only boy. And, my schooling was in Bemis. And I never got the opportunity to go to university because I was a depression child. And however, I think my experiences later on have helped me a great deal, and people I've associated with, because I have been in university secretarial groups most of my working years.
And that was your job, your working?
Yeah, that was my job, uh-huh.
And could you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, I had, I shouldn't say well.
For whom you worked and what you did?
In Decatur, I sort of wanted to see if Millikan University would be interested in a person like me. So I started there, worked in the admissions office for 4 years, and I decided I was tired of working, so I quit. And within a week, I was sorry, and because I really missed everything over there. And I found out Dr. McKay was going to need a secretary, and I wrote to him in Canada where he was taking his vacation, and he came home shortly. And I was able to take that job.
Good. Now what department was he in?
Well, he was the president.
Oh, the president.
He was the president of Millikan. Mm-hmm. And so worked there a number of years.
That must have been a very interesting position.
It was. It was just an interesting position. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm.
He was such an excellent leader.
And it was a feather in your cap that you could write a letter that would get a position like that for you.
Yes, so we would have to think of that.
Then you married?
Yes, I was married in 1936. And my husband had a heart attack while I was at Millikan, and we started gradually thinking we should go to California. On account of his health, and that we finally did. We eventually moved to California, and his health seemed pretty good out there, and then we got homesick for our families and moved back again, but he had another heart attack, and that was in 1970. That was the final one.
Well, that's too bad. So now you still aren't in the Orlando, so we need
I still
to
am not in.
Here.
Well, I sort of didn't have a real. I didn't really know what I wanted to do after his death, and I sort of rather roamed about and trying this and that. And then I did read, or it was pointed out to me in the paper, that the Oxford House said. My needs just just fine. And so I made an application there, and sure enough, I was accepted, and I lived there for 4 years. And the Astor House is probably one of the lovelier of the elder care homes in the city, I would say. And only because of the weather and our ice storms and so forth.
And the location.
And the location, yes. I can't be overlooked. It was far out. And I decided that if anything ever showed up close to downtown, I would be the first one at the door. And that is what happened when they advertised the Orlando apartments.
And so that is how you happened to be one of the early residents.
I was one of the early residents. I moved in the first month.
And then it's very fitting that you should be interested in the history.
Yes, it sort of fit into my scheme of things, because I had always heard such lovely stories about the Orlando.
Well, how did you happen to start this project of writing, investigating the Orlando history?
Well, with my former knowledge of the Orlando and the experience of having moved into the place, and I saw so many things about it that I thought other residents would really appreciate knowing about. And so I talked to the manager of the hotel, and I said, and I presented the idea with her, and I said, I just feel like I'd like to write something about it. And so she said, go ahead. And I said, well, do you want the long version or the short version? And she said the long version. And I think my main purpose was to tie this all together and give the reader a real picture of what had gone on formerly, when this was a brand new building, a beautifully decorated building, and which served so many hundreds of people, and a lot of real dignitaries who visited us. So the germ of the idea came, and I expanded on it, and people gave me things to research, and I was searching and searching. So it was a big effort. It was I'm an amateur at writing. I don't profess to be anything more than that, but it did seem that it got down on paper in pretty good shape, I guess.
Because you had so much material and information.
I did get more material than I ever needed, and sometimes I just have to condense or leave out certain things along the way.
Well, that certainly fits in with our purpose of oral history, to do exactly what you are doing, to recreate the past, make
mm-hmm.
sure that people don't forget
yes.
and know about it.
Yes.
Well, let's begin with what you found out about the hotel.
There's a man who lives here now. His name is Cody Holmes, and he was one of the residents. I don't know when he took up residence here, but he has always been around. As a boy, he was even delivering groceries to the upper story of the Powers Opera House, which was in the same location at the time. So he knew the building from, well, there was a fire of the Powers, two fires of the Power House. And later then, Mr. Powers decided it would become a hotel. But Mr. Holmes had a wealth of information, and I spent, probably an hour or two gathering up what he was remembering about it. Gave me so much help. And then I would, Mr. Shade next door, he knew a lot too, because that office has been there also for many years. And just whoever I could get, I was, sent from one to the other, and I and saying I was doing it for the Hotel Orlando seemed to open many doors.
Yeah. The first part of this recording was made on June 23, 1987, and it's being completed on July 10, 1987. Mrs. Clark, will you tell us the story of the Powers Opera House? But first, who were the Powers family?
The Powers family, the original brothers who came to Decatur, their names were Orlando and Sam. Both very wealthy people, and they thought that this was just an ideal spot for their needs at the time. Orlando had a son whose name was Charles, and he also was wealthy, and the family was probably the wealthiest in this whole part of the state at the time. Now, to complete the lineage, although Jack, the son of Charles, does not appear in this at this time. The son was Jack, son of Charles was Jack, who later we will talk about.
And they all had business interests here in the opera house and later the hotel.
Yes, but also other interests besides this. They just were into milling work and grist work.
Well, it was a great asset for Decatur when they decided to move here from Alabama.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, why did they decide to build an opera house? It seems a rather strange building for a prairie town like this, doesn't it?
Yeah, that is just a little bit, was a little bit strange to me too, but I think we forget that we didn't have like New York places to go to, or Chicago musical places. However, there was a great, great interest in music. And sometimes when the traveling groups would come through, they would perform on the lawn. I believe it was of Sam's home. They would perform on the lawn, and people would come to listen to them.
So the opera house satisfied a need of the community.
Yes, it did satisfy a need, and particularly of the of Orlando Powers generation, because they were just vitally interested in music.
Yeah.
So they did then build an opera house on this corner, and many traveling groups just performed here. It might be interesting to note here that Cody Holmes presently is living in the building. I believe he's 95 years old now. Visited this as, I think he carried groceries to the third floor of the opera house at one time. And he also performed in a couple of their theatrical performances here when he was a youth.
Well, that must have been a thrill for him.
Yes, he has a lot of...
You mentioned some fires which destroyed the opera house.
Yeah, in those days, all the buildings were made of wood, and so they were susceptible to fires, and if you had a fire, it usually destroyed the whole building. So there was number one opera house burned, and so they rebuilt the number two opera house burned.
Oh, and what a sad event. Now, they didn't rebuild it, though.
No, I guess the age of these traveling musicians was sort of coming to a close, and maybe other facilities in town had been built. I don't really understand that, but they thought a hotel would be the ideal solution to a building on this lot.
So they decided to build the hotel instead of rebuilding the opera house. Who decided to do this?
Well, this is interesting to me, and I think to most, that Charles, Charles Powers was observing the second fire, and At the same time, he pulled out a blank envelope from his pocket and started in making plans for the hotel, which is located in this area.
So he planned it during the fire that destroyed the opera house.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
And he decided to name it?
First let me say this, that he said there would be a hotel built here in 365 days, and on the 365th day, there was a gorgeous opening ball held here. So he did keep his schedule.
A man of his word.
Yes.
Well, that really is an exciting story.
Yeah, that's rather nice, story. Isn't it? Mm-hmm.
You told us the success of the plans that he made. Can you describe the opening that you talked about, this dedication or opening of a new hotel?
Well, as I recall, I don't have a great deal of knowledge about the opening. I know it was a grand affair, and ladies in those days did seem to wear just elegant dresses and jewels, and it must have been probably the biggest celebration of this kind in this part of the country.
So the hotel now is open and for business.
And business.
And there are some very distinguished guests who stayed here, I understand.
Oh, yes. yes, there were. I didn't know the first, the original important people who visited here, but we have a record of William Springer, who was a state's representative and whose name we know. John Foster Dulles was also a guest, and there was a large reception for him and an address on foreign policy, I told. John F. Kennedy, then senator from Massachusetts, and it is said that he refused to be pinned down regarding his presidential aspirations. Some other names that we know are Clark Gable, Ezio Pinza, Guy Lombardo, Charles Percy, and the Mills Brothers.
Oh, well, those are really exciting names, and it's really fun to know that those people were staying right in this very building.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I understand that, of course, there had to be changes made in the management, and I believe in about 1946, Mr. Jack Powers, the son of Charles G. Powers, returned to Decatur to take over the affair.
Well, he handled actually all the estate that was left by the Powers family, but that included, of course, the Orlando, which was a big part of the estate. And Jack, we must remember, he's the son of Charles.
Yeah, and the grandson of Orlando.
And the grandson of Orlando. He had experience with hotels, I think, probably all his life, having served at the LaSalle Hotel in Chicago as its manager. So he came here and he revamped a few rooms to make a private suite for his wife and himself. So, and he was on hand at all times as manager.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm sure that his grandfather would have been very pleased to know that his family was carrying on that mm-hmm. way. Now, we haven't actually said why the hotel was named as it was, but of course we know, we can guess.
Well, Charles, of course, was a person who built it, who planned it and built it, but he named it for his father, Orlando. And there were plaques on the front of the hotel at the time, which stated this, and I really don't know who has those plaques right now. I imagine the Parks family has them.
Well, now that brings us to the time that the hotel rooms were converted into apartments, as you explained earlier.
Yes.
So you have told us that as events changed and the needs of people changed and the method of transportation and so on, all contributed to make the need for a hotel like this a little less necessary. And so the rooms, as you have told us, were converted into apartments. So I believe that brings us up to date in our story. And do you have anything else you would like to add?
No, I think I don't. I think this has been fairly comprehensive. So I guess I have no more pertinent additions to make.
Well, you have made a real contribution to Decatur by reviewing this history of one of our outstanding landmarks. And thank you very much for helping us understand this part of Decatur's past. And we hope that the Orlando will continue to be a pleasant place for its residents to live. You have been listening to the reminiscences of Mrs. Eloise Clark, who has been telling us of her project in compiling a history of the Orlando Hotel. And this is Betty Trunell speaking for the Decatur Public Library. More about the Orlando Hotel.
Oh, how lovely.
And we really do thank you for everything that you've done and for sharing your experiences with us. It's really been fascinating to hear your reminiscences and your stories.
Really, I'm very glad to have it read by people, and I suppose it has its flaws in it. However, I was trying always to get the true facts